Self-hypnosis. Among the unpleasantries of human existence is the abashment we suffer when we feel our lives to be destitute of meaning with respect to who we are, what we do, and the general way we believe things to be in the universe. If one doubts that felt meanings are imperative to our developing or maintaining a state of good feeling, just lay your eyes on the staggering number of books and therapies for a market of individuals who suffer from a deficiency of meaning, either in a limited and localized variant, I am satisfied that my life has meaning because I received an A on my calculus exam, or one that is macrocosmic in scope, I am satisfied that my life has meaning because God loves me. Few are the readers of Norman Vincent Peale's The Power of Positive Thinking who do not feel dissatisfied with who they are, what they do, and the general way they believe things to be in the universe. Millions of copies of Peale's book and its imitations have been sold, and they are not purchased by readers well satisfied with the number or intensity of felt meanings in their lives and thus with their place on the ladder of subjective well-being, in the vernacular of positive psychology, a movement that came into its own in the early years of the 21st century with a spate of books about how almost anyone could lead happily meaningful lives. Martin Seligman, the architect of positive psychology, defines his brainchild as the science of what makes life worth living, and synopsized its principles in Authentic Happiness, using the new positive psychology to realize your potential for lasting fulfillment. There is nothing new, of course, about people searching for a happily meaningful life in a book. With the exception of sacred texts, possibly the most successful self-help manual of all time is Emile Coué's Self-Mastery Through Conscious Autosuggestion. Coué was an advocate of self-hypnosis, and there is little doubt that he had an authentically philanthropic desire to help others lead more salutary lives. On his lecture tours, he was greeted by celebrities and dignitaries around the world. Hordes turned out for his funeral in 1926. Coué is best known for urging believers in his method to repeat the following sentence: day by day, in every way, I am getting better and better. How could his readers not feel that their lives had meaning, or were proceeding toward meaningfulness, by hypnotizing themselves with these words day by day? While being alive is all right for the world's general population, some of us need to get it in writing that this is so. Every other creature in the world is insensate to meaning. But those of us on the high ground of evolution are replete with this unnatural need which any comprehensive encyclopedia of philosophy treats under the heading Life, the Meaning of. In its quest for a sense of meaning, humanity is given countless answers to questions that were never posed to it. But though our appetite for meaning may be appeased for a time, we are deceived if we think it is ever gone for good. Years may pass during which we are unmolested by life, the meaning of. Some days we wake up and innocently say, "It's good to be alive." Broken down, this exclamation means that we are experiencing an acute sense of well-being. If everyone were in such elevated spirits all the time, the topic of life, the meaning of, would never enter our minds or our philosophical reference books. But an ungrounded jubilation, or even a neutral reading on the monitor of our moods, must lapse, either intermittently or for the rest of our natural lives. Our consciousness, having snoozed while in the garden of incuriosity, is pricked by some thorn or other, perhaps death, the meaning of, or spontaneously modulates to a minor key due to the vagaries of our brain chemistry, the weather, or for causes not confirmable. Then the hunger returns for life, the meaning of. The emptiness must be filled again, the pursuit resumed. There is more on meaning in the section Unpersons, contained in the next chapter, Who Goes There? Perhaps we might gain some perspective on our earthly term if we stopped thinking of ourselves as beings who enact a life. This word is loaded with connotations to which it has no right. Instead, we should substitute existence for life, and forget about how well or badly we enact it. None of us has a life in the narrative, biographical way we think of these words. What we have are so many years of existence. It would not occur to us to say that any man or woman is in the prime of existence. Speaking of existence rather than life unclothes the latter word of its mystique. Who would ever claim that existence is all right, especially when you consider the alternative? Cosmophobia. As heretofore noted, consciousness may have assisted our species' survival in the hard times of prehistory, but as it became ever more intense, it evolved the potential to ruin everything if not securely muzzled. This is the problem. We must either outsmart consciousness or be thrown into its vortex of doleful factuality and suffer, as Zapfe termed it, a dread of being, not only of our own being, but of being itself, the idea that the vacancy that might otherwise have obtained is occupied like a stall in a public lavatory of infinite dimensions, that there is a universe in which things like celestial bodies and human beings are roving about, that anything exists in the way it seems to exist, that we are part of all being until we stop being, if there is anything we may understand as being other than semblances or the appearance of semblances. On the premise that consciousness must be obfuscated so that we might go on as well as we have all these years, Zapfe inferred that the sensible thing would be not to go on with the paradoxical nonsense of trying to inhibit our cardinal attribute as beings, since we can tolerate existence only if we believe, in accord with a complex of illusions, a leisure domain of duplicity, that we are not what we are, unreality on legs. As conscious beings, we must hold back that divulgement, lest it break us with a sense of being things without significance or foundation, anatomies shackled to a landscape of unintelligible horrors. In plain language, we cannot live except as self-deceivers, who must lie to ourselves about ourselves, as well as about our unwinnable situation in this world. Accepting the preceding statements as containing some truth, or at least for the sake of moving on with the present narrative, it seems that we are zealots of Zapfe's four plans for smothering consciousness: isolation, being alive is all right, anchoring, one nation under God with families, morality, and natural birthrights for all, distraction, better to kill time than kill oneself, and sublimation. I am writing a book titled The Conspiracy Against the Human Race. These practices make us organisms with a nimble intellect that can deceive themselves for their own good. Isolation, anchoring, distraction, and sublimation are among the wiles we use to keep ourselves from dispelling every illusion that keeps us up and running. Without this cognitive double-dealing, we would be exposed for what we are. It would be like looking into a mirror and for a moment seeing the skull inside our skin looking back at us with its sardonic smile. And beneath the skull, only blackness, nothing. Someone is there, so we feel, and yet no one is there. The uncanny paradox, all the horror in a glimpse. A little piece of our world has been peeled back, and underneath is creaking desolation, a carnival where all the rides are moving, but no patrons occupy the seats. We are missing from the world we have made for ourselves. Maybe if we could resolutely gaze wide-eyed at our lives, we would come to know what we really are. But that would stop the showy attraction we are inclined to think will run forever. Pessimism 1. Along with every other tendentious mindset, pessimism may be construed as a fluke of temperament, a shifty word that will just have to do until a better one comes along. Without the temperament that was given to them in large portion, pessimists would not see existence as basically undesirable. Optimists may have fugitive doubts about the basic desirability of existence, but pessimists never doubt that existence is basically undesirable. If you interrupted them in the middle of an ecstatic moment, which pessimists do have, and asked if existence is basically undesirable, they would reply, "Of course," before returning to their ecstasy. Why they should answer in this way is a closed book. The conclusions to which temperament lead an individual, whether or not they are conclusions refractory to those of world society, are simply not subject to analysis. Composed of the same dross as all mortals, the pessimist cleaves to whatever seems to validate his attestations. This fact should come as a shock to no one. There is no scarcity among us of those who not only want to think they are right, but also expect others to affirm their least notion as unassailable. Pessimists are no exception. But they are few, and do not show up on the radar of our race. Immune to the blandishments of religions, countries, families, and everything else that puts both average and above-average citizens in the limelight, pessimists are sideliners in both history and the media. Without belief in gods or ghosts, unmotivated by a comprehensive delusion, they should never plant a bomb, plan a revolution, or shed blood for a cause. Identical with religions that ask of their believers more than they can possibly make good on, pessimism is a set of ideals that none can follow to the letter. Those who indict a pessimist of either pathology or intellectual recalcitrance are only faking their competence to explain what cannot be explained, the mystery of why individuals are the way they are. To some extent, however, why some individuals are the way they are is not a full-fledged mystery. There are traits that run in families, legacies lurking in the genes of one generation that may profit or impair those of another. Philosophical pessimism has been called a maladaptation by those who are concerned with such things. This call seems indisputably correct. The possibility must be considered, then, that there is a genetic marker for philosophical pessimism that nature has all but deselected from our race, so that we may keep on living as we have all these years. Allowing for the theory that pessimism is weakly hereditary and is getting weaker all the time because it is maladaptive, the genes that make up the fiber of ordinary folk may someday celebrate an everlasting triumph over those of the congenitally pessimistic, ridding nature of all worry that its protocol of survival and reproduction for its most conscious species will be challenged, unless Zapfe is right and consciousness itself is maladaptive, making philosophical pessimism the correct call, despite its unpopularity among those who think, or say they think, that being alive is all right. But psychobiographers do not often take what is adaptive or maladaptive for our species into account when writing of a chosen member of the questionably dying breed of pessimists. To them, their subject's temperament has a twofold inception. 1. Life stories of tribulation, even though the pessimistic cast has no sorrows exclusive to it. 2. Intractable wrongheadedness, a charge that pessimists could turn against optimists if the argumentum ad populum were not the world's favorite fallacy. The major part of our species seems able to undergo any trauma without significantly re-examining its household mantras, including everything happens for a reason, the show must go on, accept the things you cannot change, and any other adage that gets people to keep their chins up. But pessimists cannot give themselves over to this program, and its catchwords stick in their throats. To them, the creation is objectionable and useless on principle, the worst possible dispatch of bad news. It seems so bad, so wrong, that should such authority be unwisely placed into their hands, they would make it a prosecutable malfeasance to produce a being who might turn out to be a pessimist. Disenfranchised by nature, pessimists feel that they have been impressed into this world by the reproductive liberty of positive thinkers who are ever thoughtful of the future. At whatever point in time one is situated, the future always looks better than the present, just as the present looks better than the past. No one today could write, as did the British essayist Thomas De Quincey in the early 19th century, "A quarter of man's misery is toothache." Knowing what we know of the progress toward the alleviation of human misery throughout history, who would damn their children to have a piteous toothache in the early 19th century, or in times before it, back to the days when Homo sapiens, with toothaches, scrounged to feed themselves and shivered in the cold? To the regret of pessimists, our primitive ancestors could not see that theirs was not a time in which to produce children. So, at what time was it that people knew enough to say, "This is the time in which to produce children"? When did we think that enough progress had been made toward the alleviation of human misery that children could be produced without our being torn by a crisis of conscience? The easy years of the pharaohs and Western antiquity? The lazy days of the Dark Ages? The palmy decades of the Industrial Revolution, as well as the other industry-driven periods that followed? The breakthrough era in which advancements in dentistry allayed humanity of one quarter of its misery? But few or none have ever had a crisis of conscience about producing children, because all children have been born at the best possible time in human history, or at least the one in which the most progress toward the alleviation of human misery has been made, which is always the time in which we live and have lived. While we have always looked back on previous times and thought that their progress toward the alleviation of human misery was not enough for us to want to live then, we do not know any better than the earliest Homo sapiens about what progress toward the alleviation of human misery will be made in the future, reasonably presuming that such progress will be made. And even though we may speculate about that progress, we feel no resentment about not being able to take advantage of it, or not many of us do. Nor will those of the future resent not living in the world of their future, because even greater progress toward the alleviation of human misery will by then have been made in medicine, social conditions, political arrangements, and other areas that are almost universally regarded as domains in which human life could be better. Will there ever be an end of the line in our progress toward the alleviation of human misery when people can honestly say, "This is, without doubt, the time to produce children"? And will that really be the time? No one would say, or even want to think, that theirs is a time in which people will look back on them from the future and thank their stars that they did not live in such a barbaric age that it made so little progress toward the alleviation of human misery and still produced children. As if anyone ever cared or will ever care, this is what the pessimist would say. There has never been and never will be a time in which to produce children. Now will forever be a bad time for doing that. Moreover, the pessimist would advise each of us not to look too far into the future, or we will see the reproachful faces of the unborn looking back at us from the radiant mist of their non-existence. Pessimism 2. In his lengthy study, Pessimism, James Sully wrote that a just and correct estimate of life is to be looked for in views which lean neither to the favorable nor the unfavorable pole. By this claim, Sully erred in his otherwise able dissection of his subject. People are either pessimists or optimists. They forcefully lean one way or the other, and there is no common ground between them. For pessimists, life is something that should not be, which means that what they believe should be is the absence of life, nothing, non-being, the emptiness of the uncreated. Anyone who speaks up for life as something that irrefutably should be, that we would not be better off unborn, extinct, or forever lazing in non-existence, is an optimist. It is all or nothing. One is in or one is out, abstractly speaking. Practically speaking, we have been a race of optimists since the nascency of human consciousness and lean like mad toward the favorable pole. More stylish in his examination of pessimism than Sully is the American novelist and part-time philosopher Edgar Soltis, whose philosophy of disenchantment and the anatomy of negation were written for those who treasure philosophical and literary works of a pessimistic, nihilistic, or defeatist nature as indispensable to their existence. In Soltis's estimation, a just and correct view of human life would justly and correctly determine human life as that which should not be. Controverting the absolutist standards of pessimism and optimism as outlined are heroic pessimists, or rather heroic pessimists. These are self-styled pessimists who take into consideration Sully's unfavorable poll, but are not committed to its entailment that life is something that should not be. In his Tragic Sense of Life in Men and Nations, the Spanish writer Miguel de Unamuno speaks of consciousness as a disease bred by a conflict between the rational and the irrational. The rational is identified with the conclusions of consciousness, primarily that we will all die. The irrational represents all that is vital in humanity, including a universal desire for immortality in either a physical or non-physical state. The coexistence of the rational and the irrational turns the human experience into a wrangle of contradictions to which we can bow our heads in resignation or defy as heroes of futility. Unamuno's penchant was for the heroic course, with the implied precondition that one has the physical and psychological spunk for the fight. In line with Unamuno, Joshua Foa Dienstag, author of Pessimism, Philosophy, Ethic, Spirit, is also a proselytizer for a healthy, heroic pessimism, quotes implied, that faces up to much of the dispiriting lowdown on life, all radically pessimistic visions being cropped out of the picture, and marches on toward a future believed to be personally and politically workable. Also siding with this never-say-die group is William R. Brashear, whose The Desolation of Reality concludes with a format for redemption, however partial and imperfect, by holding tight to what he calls tragic humanism, which recognizes human life's ostensible insignificance, but also the necessity of proceeding as if this were not so, willfully nourishing and sustaining the underlying illusions of value and order. How we nourish and sustain illusions of value and order in our lives is explained in Zapfe's The Last Messiah. How we might nourish and sustain at will what we know to be illusions without a covenant of ignominious pretense among us is not explained by Brashear and has never been explained by anyone else who espouses this façon de vivre. Not in the same class of pessimism as the antinatalist Zapfe, Unamuno, Dienstag, and Brashear meet existence more than halfway, safely joined in solidarity with both ordinary and sophisticated folk, who take their lumps like grown-ups and, by doing so, retain their status with the status quo. Attuned as they may be to the pessimist's attitude that life is something which should not be, they do not approve of it. But Unamuno, Dienstag, and Brashear's solution to the pessimist's rejection of life puts us in the same paradoxical bind that Zapfe sees in human existence, that is, living with the pretense that being alive is all right. The only difference is that Unamuno, Dienstag, and Brashear knowingly accede to a pretense that ordinary folk shirk knowing, at least as a general rule, because even average mortals are sometimes forced to admit this pretense. They just do not linger over it long enough to make it a philosophical point of pride and sing their own praises for doing so. A philosophical cohort of Unamuno, Dienstag, and Brashear is the French existentialist writer Albert Camus. In his essay The Myth of Sisyphus, Camus represents the unattainable goal of the title figure as an apologetic for going on with life rather than ending it. As he insists in his discussion of this gruesome parable, we must imagine Sisyphus as happy, as he rolls his boulder to the top of the mountain, from which it always tumbles down again and again and again to his despair. the credo of the Church Father Tertullian, I believe because it is absurd, might justly be placed in the context of Camus' belief that being alive is all right, or all right enough, though it may be absurd. Indeed, the connection has not been overlooked. Caught between the irrationality of the Carthaginian and the intellectuality of the Frenchman, Zapfe's proposal that we put out the light of the human race extends to us an antidote for our existential infirmities that is infinitely more satisfying than that of either Tertullian or his avatar Camus, the latter of whom meditated on suicide as a philosophical issue for the individual, yet did not entertain the advantages of an all-out attrition of the species. By not doing so, one might conclude that Camus was only being practical. In the end, though, his insistence that we must imagine Sisyphus as happy is as impractical as it is feculent. Like Unamuno, Dienstag, and Brashear, Camus believed we can assume a view of life that can content us with the tragedy, nightmare, and meaninglessness of human existence. Camus may have been able to assume this view of life before his life ended in a vehicular misadventure, but he must have been jesting to pose it as a possibility or a duty for the world. It would be a sign of callowness to bemoan the fact that pessimistic writers do not rate and may be reprehended in both good conscience and good company. Some critics of the pessimist often think they have his back to the wall when they blithely jeer, "If that is how this fellow feels, he should either kill himself or be decried as a hypocrite." That the pessimist should kill himself in order to live up to his ideas may be counterattacked as betraying such a crass intellect that it does not deserve a response. Yet it is not much of a chore to produce one. Simply because someone has reached the conclusion that the amount of suffering in this world is enough that anyone would be better off never having been born, does not mean that by force of logic or sincerity he must kill himself. It only means he has concluded that the amount of suffering in this world is enough that anyone would be better off never having been born. Others may disagree on this point as it pleases them, but they must accept that if they believe themselves to have a stronger case than the pessimist, they are mistaken. Naturally, there are pessimists who do kill themselves, but nothing obliges them to kill themselves or live with the mark of the hypocrite on their brow. Voluntary death might seem a thoroughly negative course of action, but it is not as simple as that. Every negation is adulterated or stealthily launched by an affirmative spirit. An unequivocal no cannot be uttered or acted upon. Lucifer's last words in heaven may have been non servium, but none has served the Almighty so dutifully, since his sideshow in the clouds would never draw any customers if it were not for the main attraction of the devil's hell on earth. Only catatonics and coma patients can persevere in a dignified withdrawal from life's rattle and hum. Without a yes in our hearts, nothing would be done, and to be done with our existence en masse would be the most ambitious affirmation of all. Most people think that vitality is betokened only by such phenomena as people in their 80s who hike mountain trails or nations that build empires. This way of thinking is simply naive, but it keeps up our morale, because we like to imagine we will be able to hike mountain trails when we are in our 80s, or live as citizens of a nation that has built an empire. And so the denunciations of critics who say the pessimist should kill himself or be decried as a hypocrite make every kind of sense in a world of card-carrying or crypto-optimists. Once this is understood, the pessimist can spare himself from suffering more than he need at the hands of normal people, a confederation of upstanding creatures who in concert keep the conspiracy going. This is not to say that such individuals do not suffer so much and in such a way that they sometimes kill themselves, possibly even more per capita than do pessimists, or that because they kill themselves they are hypocrites for ever having said that anyone is better off for having been born. It is only to say that when normal individuals kill themselves, even after having said that anyone is better off for having been born, They are disqualified as normal individuals, because normal individuals do not kill themselves, but until their dying day think that being alive is all right, and that happiness will stand out in the existence of life's newcomers, who, it is always assumed, will be as normal as they are. Blundering. Consciousness is an existential liability, as every pessimist agrees. A blunder of blind nature, according to Zapfe, that has taken humankind down a black hole of logic. To make it through this life, we must make believe that we are not what we are, contradictory beings whose continuance only worsens our plight as mutants who embody the contorted logic of a paradox. To correct this blunder, we should desist from procreating. What could be more judicious or more urgent, existentially speaking, than our self-administered oblivion? At the very least, we might give some regard to this theory of the blunder as a thought experiment. All civilizations become defunct. All species die out. There is even an expiration date on the universe itself. Human beings would certainly not be the first phenomenon to go belly up. But we could be the first to precipitate our own passing, abbreviating it before the bodies really started to stack up. Could we know, to their most fine-grained details, the lives of all those who came before us? Would we bless them for the care they took to keep the race blundering along? Could we exhume them alive? Would we thankfully shake their bony undead hands and promise to pass on the favor of living to future generations? Surely that is what they would want to hear, or at least that is what we want to think they would want to hear. And just as surely that is what we would want to hear from our descendants living in far posterity, strangers though they would be as they shook our bony undead hands. Nature proceeds by blunders. That is its way. It is also ours. So, if we have blundered by regarding consciousness as a blunder, why make a fuss over it? Our self-removal from this planet would still be a magnificent move, a feat so luminous it would bedim the sun. What do we have to lose? No evil would attend our departure from this world, and the many evils we have known would go extinct along with us. So why put off what would be the most laudable masterstroke of our existence, and the only one? Of course, phenomena other than consciousness have been thought to be blunders, beginning with life itself. For example, in a novel titled At the Mountains of Madness, the American writer H.P. Lovecraft has one of his characters mention a primal myth about great old ones who filtered down from the stars and concocted Earth life as a joke or mistake. Schopenhauer, once he had drafted his own mythology that everything in the universe is energized by a will to live, shifted to a common-sense pessimism to represent life as a congeries of excruciations. Life presents itself by no means as a gift for enjoyment, but as a task, a drudgery to be performed, and in accordance with this we see, in great and small, universal need, ceaseless cares, constant pressure, endless strife, compulsory activity, with extreme exertion of all the powers of body and mind. Many millions, united into nations, strive for the common good, each individual on account of his own, but many thousands fall as a sacrifice for it. Now senseless delusions, now intriguing politics, incite them to wars with each other. Then the sweat and the blood of the great multitude must flow to carry out the ideas of individuals or to expiate their faults. In peace, industry and trade are active, inventions work miracles, seas are navigated, delicacies are collected from all ends of the world, the waves engulf thousands, all push and drive, others acting, the tumult is indescribable. But the ultimate aim of it all, what is it? To sustain ephemeral and tormented individuals through a short span of time, in the most fortunate case, with endurable want and comparative freedom from pain, which, however, is at once attended with ennui? than the reproduction of this race and its striving. In this evident disproportion between the trouble and the reward, the will to live appears to us from this point of view, if taken objectively, as a fool, or subjectively, as a delusion, seized by which everything living works with the utmost exertion of its strength for something that is of no value. But when we consider it more closely, we shall find here also that it is rather a blind pressure, a tendency entirely without ground or motive. Schopenhauer is here straightforward in limning his awareness that, for human beings, existence is a state of demonic mania, with the will to live as the possessing spirit of ephemeral and tormented individuals. Elsewhere in his works, he denominates consciousness as an accident of life, a blunder, a mistake. Is there really anything behind our smiles and tears but an evolutionary slip-up? Analogies. Schopenhauer's is a great pessimism, not least because it reveals a signature motif of the pessimistic imagination. As indicated, Schopenhauer's insights are yoked to a philosophical superstructure centered on the will, or the will to live, a blind, deaf, and dumb force that rouses human beings to their detriment. While Schopenhauer's system of thought is as impossible to swallow as that of any other systematic philosopher, no intelligent person can fail to see that every living thing behaves exactly in conformity with his philosophy in its liberal articulation. Wound up like toys by some force, call it will, elan vital, anima mundi, physiological or psychological processes, nature or whatever, organisms go on running as they are bidden until they run down. In pessimistic philosophies, only the force is real, not the things activated by it. They are only puppets, and if they have consciousness, may mistakenly believe they are self-winding persons who are making a go of it on their own. Here, then, is the signature motif of the pessimistic imagination that Schopenhauer made discernible. Behind the scenes of life, there is something pernicious that makes a nightmare of our world. For Zapfe, the evolutionary mutation of consciousness tugged us into tragedy. For Michael Stetter, individuals can exist only as unrealities that are made as they are made and that cannot make themselves otherwise because their hands are forced by the god of philopsychia, self-love, to accept positive illusions about themselves or not accept themselves at all. For Mainländer, a will to die, not Schopenhauer's will to live, plays the occult master pulling our strings, making us dance in fitful motions like marionettes caught in a turbulent wake left by the passing of a self-murdered god. For Bonzen, a purposeless force breathes a black life into everything and feasts upon it part by part, regurgitating itself into itself, ever renewing the throbbing forms of its repast. For all others who suspect that something is amiss in the lifeblood of being, something they cannot verbalize, there are the malformed shades of suffering and death that chase them into the false light of contenting lies. By analogy with that pernicious something the pessimist senses behind the scenes of life are the baleful agencies that govern the world of supernatural horror fiction. Actually, it would be more proper to speak of the many worlds of supernatural horror, since they vary from author to author as much as the renderings of the human fiasco vary from pessimist to pessimist. Even within the writings of a single author, the source of something pernicious that makes a nightmare of our world switches about, the common link being a state of affairs that overturns our conception of reality for the worse. In The Willows, for instance, the 20th-century British writer Algernon Blackwood suggests that an inimical force abides within nature. What this enormity might be is known to the characters of the story only by mysterious signs and sounds that unnerve them as they make their way in a small boat down the Danube and camp for the night on an island overgrown with willows, which become the symbolic focus of a region where nature shows its most menacing aspect. The narrator tries to explain what it is about the willows that seems particularly threatening to him, as distinct from the more immediate perils of the severe weather conditions that have developed along the Danube. A rising river, perhaps, always suggests something of the ominous. Many of the little islands I saw before me would probably have been swept away by the morning. This resistless, thundering water touched the deep sense of awe. Yet I was aware that my uneasiness lay deeper far than the emotions of awe and wonder. It was not that I felt, nor had it directly to do with the power of the driving wind, this shouting hurricane that might almost carry up a few acres of willows into the air and scatter them like so much chaff over the landscape. The wind was simply enjoying itself, for nothing rose out of the flat landscape to stop it, and I was conscious of sharing its great game with a kind of pleasurable excitement. Yet this novel emotion had nothing to do with the wind. Indeed, so vague was the sense of distress I experienced that it was impossible to trace it to its source and deal with it accordingly, though I was aware somehow that it had to do with our utter insignificance before this unrestrained power of the elements about me. The huge grown river had something to do with it, too, a vague, unpleasant idea that we had somehow trifled with these great elemental forces in whose power we lay helpless every hour of the day and night. For here, indeed, they were gigantically at play together, and the sight appealed to the imagination. But my emotion, so far as I could understand it, seemed to attach itself more particularly to the willow bushes, to these acres and acres of willows, crowding, so thickly growing there, swarming everywhere the eye could reach, pressing upon the river as though to suffocate it, standing in dense array mile after mile beneath the sky, watching, waiting, listening. And, apart from the elements, the willows connected themselves subtly with my malaise, attacking the mind insidiously somehow by reason of their vast numbers, and contriving in some way or other to represent to the imagination a new and mighty power, a power, moreover, not altogether friendly to us. The mystery of the pernicious something that the willows represent is never resolved. However, at the end of the story, the two travelers see a man turning over and over in the rushing river, and he bears their mark in the form of indentations they had seen before in the sands of the island, funnels that formed and grew in size throughout the night the men had camped on the island. Whatever power that was not altogether friendly to us had procured its victim and satisfied itself. The men had been saved at the price of another's death. That which makes a nightmare of our world had revealed itself for a time, and withdrawn once again behind the scenes of life. Such is the motif of supernatural horror. Something terrible in its being comes forward and makes its claim as a shareholder in our reality, or what we think is our reality and ours alone. It may be an emissary from the grave, or an esoteric monstrosity, as in the ghost stories of M. R. James. It may be the offspring of a scientific experiment with unintended consequences, as in Arthur Machen's The Great God Pan, or the hitherto unheard-of beings in the same author's The White People. It may be a hideous token of another dimension revealed only in a mythic tome, as in Robert W. Chambers's The Yellow Sign. Or it may be a world unto itself of pure morbidity, one suffused with a profound sense of a doom without a name, Edgar Allan Poe's world. Reflected in the works of many supernatural writers, the signature motif Schopenhauer made discernible in pessimism was most consistently promulgated by Lovecraft, a paragon among literary figures who have thought the unthinkable, or at least thought what most mortals do not want to think. In conceiving Azathoth, that nuclear chaos which bubbles at the center of all infinity, Lovecraft might well have been thinking of Schopenhauer's will. As instantiated in Lovecraft's stories, the pernicious something that makes a nightmare of our world is individuated into linguistically teratological entities from beyond or outside of our universe. Like ghosts or the undead, their very existence spooks us as a violation of what should and should not be, suggesting unknown modes of being and uncanny creations which epitomize supernatural horror.